This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, July 21st, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Ken Freeland. We talked earlier, last year, we talked about political ponderology. And today we are going to cover someone else. We are going to talk about an individual by the name of Roy Tove. And he has a website. His website is roytove.com. That's R-O-Y-T-O-V.com. So welcome to the program, Ken.
Well, good to be back, Deanna. How are you?
I'm very well. And you?
I'm fine.
Good. So you were going to talk about Roy and his situation. I do have his book, and the name of the book is entitled The Cross of Bethlehem. And it is basically, let me tell you what it says on the back. The Cross of Bethlehem is a memoir of a Christian Israeli military officer caught in the crosshairs between a country that demands total obedience, even if that means firing on rock-throwing women and children and following his following his conscience. In a story of faith and courage, tragedy and hope, the author, Roy Tove, shares the heartache of growing up as an outsider in the tight-knit kibbutzim along the Jordan Valley. And so basically he left that land, he left that mentality, he embraced Christianity, and the book is basically his story of what happened thereafter. He did have to leave the country, he's a refugee. And he made a lot of changes in his life, which were most difficult and also very dangerous for him physically and in every other way. So what are your thoughts? Are you there?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's see. Let me start with how I first came into contact with Roy. Somehow, I don't know how, he apparently got my name, and that's not hard to do because I'm involved in a lot of anti-Zionist correspondence. And I began receiving his regular weekly, not quite weekly, but his periodic essays, which are what I'm really here to help promote, I think, because anybody can subscribe to them through his website, and they're free. And they're very, very, very worthwhile, as I know.
Absolutely.
You'll agree, Deanna, because I do these sometimes on other websites, on other listservs.
And you were saying that you can subscribe to
right.
his periodic
yes.
emails, which I have been doing for some time. And I've always enjoyed these articles that he writes. They're very insightful and very comprehensive. And I wanted to interview him, and of course, since his he has some health issues and is not able to really communicate as well as he would like, and so this is what we thought would bring some attention to his plight, as well as some attention to his articles.
Right.
Even though he could not participate in the interview, we're just going to have one without him and promote his writing.
Right. Well, as I was saying, when I started reading his earlier offerings, they were incredibly, as you say, insightful and brought in what we might call intelligence that was unavailable through other sources. However, at that time, the English in his English language versions was really atrocious. It was horrible, frankly, and almost made it illegible. So recognizing the value of what he was trying to do and the difficulty in reading through the English effort that he was making, I volunteered to edit his work for a while, which I did. And that's how I got to know Roy a little more personally. Since that time, Roy has apparently found another editor, which I appreciate, because his weekly or his periodic essays now are quite legible, and they're in very good English. So That's not an issue anymore. But so Roy and I do know each other to some degree, and he was aware that Deanna wanted to interview him, but he's just not able to, not only for health reasons, but for technical reasons. He has a very limited ability to access the internet and to do it in a way that he feels is secure. And security is a very big issue with Roy, as we should probably discuss when we discuss his plight, because he has received, in the year 2005, I believe it was, a political refugee status in Bolivia. However, you know, since that time, he's been harassed in different kinds of ways, as we can imagine, by the powers that be that do not appreciate his anti-Zionist pieces and publications. And this has led to what he believes is the theft of his personal papers, his identity papers, which make it impossible for him at this point to traverse to any other country. So he, in effect, is a prisoner in Bolivia. The Bolivian government at this point is not willing to help him. They put the burden of proof on him rather than him being able to enlist their support to help regain his papers that would be necessary to enable him to travel and so forth. And an American lawyer who has volunteered to look at his case actually agreed, and that he is in the status of a political prisoner. So that's, it's fair, I think, to say that that's his real situation, that he is a political prisoner, even though it's not fair to say that Bolivia has captured him and made him a political prisoner. It's more of a circumstance that he happens to be in Bolivia, and, you know, he feels that he is better off in Bolivia than he would be if he tried to step across the border and go into any neighboring South American country where he feels the situation would actually be worse. So it's kind of the least of the evils situation for him, but he survives by the sale of his book and also by people linking to Amazon.com from his website and purchasing anything else from Amazon.com. I don't think he's making all kinds of money off of this. He's struggling. So and of course, from personal donations, people are always welcome to just, you know, send him money if they feel sympathy for his situation. So that's, I think, the long and the short of his immediate biography. In talking with him in advance of this interview, I asked him what he thought would be a good sample piece of his work to read to folks. And he recommended a recent piece called Israel Admits War Causes Were Fabricated. Would you like me to read that, Deanna?
That would be great, yes.
Okay.
I was trying to find his donation button here on the homepage. I know that he has had a PayPal mm-hmm. previously, mm-hmm. But he's got a lot of books that you can purchase, as you say, via his website and straight through to Amazon.
Yeah, I should mention that you know, Deanna, that you mentioned the title of his book was Cross of Bethlehem, but he wrote a sequel called Cross of Bethlehem 2, I believe.
Right.
So there are two books of that basic title available, both of which I assume to be you know, autobiographical.
Right. And you can also get them in a Kindle format, which I think is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Well, this piece, let's see, when was it published? I sent it out Friday the 13th of July, so it's pretty recent. It was earlier this month that it was written. In fact, I believe the publication date is July 12th.
Okay, so the article is entitled?
The article is entitled, Israel Admits War Causes Were Fabricated.
I think you could apply that to just about any war that that we've ever been engaged in.
I couldn't agree with you more, Deanna. But of course, this is a current situation, so it's that's why it's extremely important that people understand. It's actually not current, but the revelation is current. This is
exactly
when it's the fabrications that you're discussing are all true, but they're seldom admitted. Here, this is an actual admission of a fabricated war purpose.
Right.
So that's what makes it really valuable. The subtitle is, "Even Before the Hezbollah War, Israel Knew It Was Hopeless to Retrieve Abducted IDF Soldiers." Just to refresh people's memory, you know, there were these two captured Israeli soldiers that were causing no end of consternation to the Israeli government, and they finally used it as an excuse to invade Lebanon. But we'll see here about how much they really believe that that was the reason for the war. Okay, beginning the article now. "Being absolved of a long list of crimes doesn't give one the right to incriminate oneself in other crimes. Yet, that is exactly what former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert did today. On July 12, 2012, 2 days before being acquitted, he spoke at a conference in Tel Aviv, which was devoted to the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel." I'm going to make a personal comment here just to remind people that he was not acquitted of anything having to do with the war. He was acquitted of some personal corruption charges. Okay, right, back to the article. "While the media recorded his astonishing words, he admitted that Israel's main excuse for its brutal attack on Lebanon, the retrieval of two captured soldiers, was false. The war had one objective, which we did not achieve, and knew in advance that we couldn't achieve. And it was spoken in cabinet meetings," Olmert said. "The prime minister, the government, and the army knew that. Openly deceiving the entire world, they attacked for the sake of achieving a different target. In the morning hours of July 12, 2006, Hezbollah launched a diversionary rocket attack toward Israeli military strongholds near the coast, not far from Zarait." That's spelled Z-I-R-A-I-T. "Hezbollah soldiers crossed the border into Israel and attacked a patrol of two Israeli Humvees. In the event, three IDF soldiers were killed, two were injured, and two others were captured. Master Sergeant Ehud Goldwasser and First Sergeant Eldad Regev were taken by the Hezbollah soldiers to Lebanon. This event marked the beginning of a 34-day-long war between Israel and Hezbollah. Kidnapped soldiers blamed the Israeli, kidnapped soldiers blared the Israeli headlines. I was surprised. Since when is a soldier kidnapped?" Kidnapped is in quotes there because that was the term they were using. "Were they watering their mother's gardens at the time? No, they were participating in military events. Soldiers are never kidnapped. They are captured. Afterwards, they should be treated according to the International Geneva Convention. That one simple semantic deceit by the Israeli media kidnapped the nation's mind. The Israeli government used the event to fulfill a different agenda. Shortly after their capture, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert described the event as an act of war by Lebanon. He didn't mention the fact that Israel has continuously carried out similar acts in Lebanon ever since Operation Litania in 1978. He didn't mention the fact that Israel has continually, he didn't mention the fact that the Lebanese government wasn't involved. Moreover, it couldn't be involved because Israel had damaged the Lebanese government control over the southern parts of the country. Olmert said then that Lebanon will bear the consequences of its actions, and that it will suffer a very painful and far-reaching response. IDF's Chief of Staff Dan Halutz said, if the soldiers are not returned, we will turn Lebanon's clock back 20 years. While the commander of Israel's Northern Command, Uri Adam, added, this affair is between Israel and the state of Lebanon. Where to attack? Once it is inside Lebanon, everything is legitimate, not just southern Lebanon, not just the line of Hezbollah posts. Yet they knew the captured soldiers were already dead. The next day, Israeli The next day, I think this is a typo, the next day Israel destroyed Beirut's international airport and began a brutal, systematic destruction of Lebanon. Israel's Air Force flew more than 12,000 combat missions. Its Navy fired over 2,500 shells, and its artillery fired over 100,000 shells. 400 miles of roads and 73 bridges were destroyed. Roughly 150,000 houses, 350 schools, and two hospitals were hit, as well as facility structures like water and sewage treatment plants, electrical facilities, fuel stations, commercial structures, and others. Yet this time, Israel miscalculated. Israelis found themselves running south, away from the bombings, all the way down to the Jezreel Valley, the valley connecting Mount Carmel with the Jordan River. Jezreel is deep within the Israeli heartland, a place most Israelis consider equivalent to the U.S. state of Kansas in geographical terms. The implications of the situation escaped international eyes. For the first time since the foundation of the State of Israel, a significant percentage of its population ran away from their homes because their government failed to protect them. Actually was responsible for initiating the military operation that led to the disaster. Up to 500,000 Israelis were displaced. The situation was so bad that Israel agreed to a ceasefire provisioned by United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701 on August 14th. Hezbollah and Israel both declared victory. The two captured soldiers, having unwittingly caused this massacre, remained in the hands of Hezbollah. Their bodies were returned to Israel on July 16, 2008, as part of a prisoner exchange. In exchange, Hezbollah got from Israel the incarcerated Palestinian Liberation Front militant Samir Kuntar. Four Hezbollah militants captured during the war, and the bodies of about 200 other Lebanese and Palestinian militants. The brutal Israeli reaction was odd, especially since Hezbollah had announced its readiness to indirectly negotiate the release of the soldiers, as had been done several times in the past. Yet Prime Minister Olmert blamed Lebanon and purposely created a situation that could not be solved. There was nothing the Lebanese government could do. In other words, Olmert forced the war, knowing that the war had one objective which we did not achieve, and knew in advance that we couldn't achieve, and it was spoken in cabinet meetings. Again, that's a quote from Olmert. In the same conference, Olmert also admitted that we said that we were working to bring about the two soldiers' release. However, we had no doubts that it was so, that they were no longer alive. And he added, those who had participated in cabinet meetings at the time knew there wasn't a chance to bring them back through a military operation. Then, Mr. Olmert, why did you carry out the massacre? The actions of the IDF were a complete disaster. The army commander back then was Dan Halutz, an Air Force officer. He also participated in today's conference. This is on July 12th. It is unusual for a blue, which is to say somebody from the Air Force in Hebrew slang, to reach such a position. Halutz held back the Greens, in other words, the ground forces, during the operation because he didn't trust them and sent the Air Force ahead. It was a disaster. The fact that in the morning of the attack he found time to contact his broker and sell his stock in the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange didn't help his public image. He felt humiliated after having shown the world where the real interests of a senior IDF commanders are.
Amazing.
Isn't that something? Sort of reminds you of 9/11 and the put options, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Okay, sorry. Mr. Olmert wasn't kind enough to inform us on why he took the odd decision to blame and attack Lebanon. Yet his actions give a very solid testimony that he had begun the war not to save the captured soldiers, but to destroy Hezbollah. The two soldiers were used as a mere justification for a military action that he couldn't justify otherwise, not even to the Israeli public. A collateral collaboration of this is what is known as the last 48 hours. It refers to the last 2 days before the ceasefire, when Israel began a wild offensive, knowing it was the last chance to hit additional targets. Olmert said this was done in an attempt to force the UN to change its final wording of its ceasefire decision. There wasn't an intention to change strategy, just to create the required effect to bring the international community to finalize things in a direction which we perceived as the right one. That's a quote. In other words, the Jewish heart he presented towards the Israeli electorate, "We will bring back the boys," was nothing but a cold political calculation.
Right, and of course that's what they always do. We're going to bring the people back, bring our soldiers back from Iraq, or bring the soldiers back from Afghanistan, when in fact that's not their intention at all.
Support the troops.
Support the troops.
And the last paragraph here, "Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot," says the Bible in Exodus 21:24. It may seem a bit barbaric nowadays, but back then it established the idea of proportional punishment, and in nearby texts, a method of indemnification for crimes committed. These days, if your neighbor breaks the window in your house, you expect to get a new window and some degree of compensation if the damage was intentional. No modern society would accept the retaliatory breaking of the neighbor's window, demolishing his house, as the Israelis do in Lebanon and the occupied territories, as a just response. For a long time now, Israelis have been running amok in this violent manner. Having rejected their last teacher, they are now forgetting even legal morals, receding dangerously back to lawless times. "Masada won't fall a second time," quote unquote, are the words used by Israeli soldiers to swear allegiance to their country. 2 millennia ago, Masada was an impressive fortress overlooking the Dead Sea. A small Jewish sect occupied it and withstood the Roman siege for a few years. Surrounded by high cliffs on all sides, an early version of the modern Israeli wall around the Palestinian territories, the place seemed unconquerable. Food reserves within the walls and sophisticated wells ensured survival in the arid landscape. But the Romans were resourceful and built a ramp all the way up. Nowadays it is called the Snake Way due to its undulating shape around the cliffs, and it is still the only way to reach the top by foot. The nearby cable car is a modern contrivance. When the Romans reached the top, Masada's people committed suicide to avoid captivity. Only one woman and her children survived to tell the tale. Masada is a powerful myth for Israelis. They like to consider their tiny country without a constitution, without agreed-upon borders, and with racist laws discriminating amongst its citizens, a kind of modern Masada. The word is even used as a code name for certain strategic military plans. "Masada won't fall for a second time," say the Israeli soldiers when swearing loyalty. Young children disguised as soldiers shout with all their might while tightly closing their eyes to reality. After the 2006 war, "Masada won't fall a second time" sounds more than ever like a hollow teenager bravado statement. Will the veil covering Israeli eyes fall away? Will new enlightened leaders seek a just political solution to their problems? More probably, we will just witness a Masada reenactment. Running south, they will keep shouting, "Masada won't fall for a second time," deep into the dusty desert of oblivion.
Wow.
Yeah.
What I found so amazing is all of the destruction that they perpetrated in Lebanon. I mean, that was significant.
Mm-hmm.
150,000 houses, 350 schools. I mean, that is just...
2 hospitals?
Yes.
But of course, that's the Israeli MO. I mean, they don't have any problem with doing the same thing to hospitals in Gaza either. It's
right.
Not a big deal.
73 bridges, yeah. And all these facilities really destroyed the water and sewage treatment plants, the electrical facilities, fuel stations, commercial structures. And basically, that's the exact same thing that the U.S. military did in Iraq.
Exactly. And not just in Iraq. I personally...
In Afghanistan.
I personally went on a tour of Serbia, Yugoslavia at that time, right after the U.S. war against them. And they had done the same thing to the Serbs. They had attacked their civilian infrastructure, their water supply, their electrical system. It was not any different.
My goodness. And but the thing about this article is the fact that they actually admit that down in this one paragraph, he says the two soldiers were used as a mere justification for a military action that he couldn't justify otherwise, not even to the Israeli public.
Yeah.
And Olmert says that.
Mm-hmm. It's quite candid and quite revealing. It's really a pretty nice role model for what U.S. leaders should be doing. They should be admitting their own pretext, false pretext for war. But, of course, we have to have researchers dig to find out this stuff. Whereas in Israel, I guess they just say, well, we did it. Yeah, that's right.
Right. And of course, Roy probably has, as you said before, kind of insider information mm-hmm. that he can write this stuff. And he has been attacked for doing so.
Absolutely.
And yet his courage just won't allow him to remain silent.
No, he's actually, he's more of a prisoner of conscience than he is a political prisoner. He actually is almost compulsorily letting people know about these things, that he is able to get the inside information on. How he gets his information, I do not know, but that he gets it and that he puts it out there where people can see it. And I think this article was, in fact, a very, very good example of the kind of work that he does. And he does this he's incredibly prodigious. He publishes, I think, an average of at least one article a week like this, of this magnitude, of this quality.
Right, and people can read those articles by going to roytove.com. That's ROYTOV.com. And if you just scroll down, there's an introduction right at the top. And if you just scroll down, then you will see a list of the articles. I forgot to unplug my phone here. A list of the articles. And if you just look at the one that we're talking about today, let's see, where is it? Where did I see it? We need to let people know how they can get there. The name of it, Israel Admits War Causes Were Fabricated. And I'm trying to let people know how they can get to that article.
Well, the original I can just give the URL if you want.
Okay, yeah. Okay, here it is. Okay, if you go to the homepage and then you scroll down, it says New in the Website and Highlights. It's about the third box down, and it is about seven articles down on the left. And when you go to this article, if you look on the left, he has in very little letters, Donate. I knew he had a donate button somewhere on his website, but it's not real easy to find. Mm-hmm. And I do hope that our listeners will consider donating to him because that's how he lives. And he can't go out and get a job. He is a prisoner, basically,
right.
And he doesn't have any paperwork. He doesn't have any, he's without sources. He's without resources.
Yeah. He also doesn't have a stable domicile. From what I understand, he doesn't feel comfortable because of his situation living any place for any period of time long enough to be a target. So he moves around quite a bit. He moves his location. So he's constantly on the move, and yet he finds time to really write several articles, almost several articles a week. It's hard to keep up with. If you say that it's the seventh one down, then that means it's since July 12th, and today's the 21st, so that's 1 week. He's had six articles. I mean,
yes.
sometimes he is that productive. It's incredible.
Right. And he has been physically attacked, and the reason that he really can't do an interview himself is because of damage to his vocal cords.
Yes, he's got residual damage from his from the attack on him that have left him somewhat speechless, I guess.
Yes, but certainly not silent.
Nope.
certainly not silent. And in his book, he talks about how he grew up and his experience growing up in Israel. And it's a very good book, and I urge people to purchase this book and his second one, whether you buy it hard copy or Kindle. I do hope that people will support Roy in his efforts, and certainly he needs to know that there are people out here who care about what he does, and that we really do appreciate the articles that he writes and the sacrifices that he has made in order to write those articles and to live the way that he does and to stand up for what his conscience tells him. And I think that takes a great deal of courage.
Agreed. And once again, people can also support him in a lesser way by going to his website and linking from there to Amazon.com before you make any purchases through Amazon.com, and he will get a percentage of your purchase. And also don't forget to sign up for his newsletter where through which you'll receive all of his pieces as he publishes them. They'll come right to your email box. All you got to do is give him your email address on the website there.
Great. All righty. Well, as I say, thank you so much for doing this, Ken. I really appreciate your participation and your efforts.
Thank you, Dana. It's been my pleasure, and I hope folks will have been suitably impressed by the quality of Roy Taub's work and his courageous example.
Yes, the example, yes, absolutely. All righty. Thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.